listening to the CCA Podcast.
Beginning of a journey through this book. We've encouraged the congregation to read the Bible through this year. And the preaching, the messages each Sunday will flow out of the context of where we're reading. So right now we're in the middle of the life of Joseph. We're just beginning to focus on his life, the end of Genesis. And Joseph is It's one of the most fascinating stories in the Old Testament, I think. It's one of the longest. It's one of the most extensive. We have several chapters that are devoted to this story that reads really like a novel. It's a story of a man with a dream, but then having that dream dashed and being rejected by his family and then taken captive and taken into Egypt where he grows up, and then the question of, you know, what's going to happen? And then there he's falsely accused. And of Joseph, you know, is this dream going to come to fulfillment? And then it actually does come to fulfillment, and then his brothers don't realize that that's happened. It's a wild story. It begins in Genesis chapter 37. And it says in verse 2, it says, this is the account of Jacob. Joseph, a young man, so Joseph is Jacob's son. Joseph, a young man, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, and his father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. Well, when you're the youngest, 17, amongst all the brothers, bringing a bad report about your 10 older brothers is probably not a good way to win friends and influence people. You know, it's, and especially because Joseph was the favored son of Jacob. He was the favored son because he was the son of Rachel, and Rachel was his first love. Rachel was the one that he had first fallen in love with and worked 7 years to win, and then he ended up having to work another 7 years because his father-in-law tricked him and gave him Leah instead. And how'd you like to be Leah, like the instead wife? You know, that's a bummer too, right? But God blesses Leah and gives her a bunch of kids and a bunch of sons, and she's like, yes, I'm winning over my, you know, over my younger sister. But Jacob always had a thing for Rachel, and he always had a thing then for Rachel's sons, for Joseph. So Joseph is already kind of in a bad place in terms of bringing a bad report about his brothers, because he's the favorite son. So when he brings a bad report, they get so mad that they do this incredible kind of thing. They actually sell him into slavery. There are some distant relatives, the Ishmaelites, who are coming by, and they come up with this idea of, hey, let's, you know, they're thinking about killing him. And then they determine, well, nah, it's probably, he is our brother after all. And so they sell him into slavery, and the Ishmaelites take him down into Egypt, where he then spends several years in slavery. The thing about Joseph is that early on, God had given him some dreams. He'd given him a dream about being in the field and harvesting wheat, and then that the sheaves of his brothers were bowing down to his sheave, and his sheave was standing up. And he made the mistake of telling that to his brothers. And then there was another one about the stars bowing down to him, and then the moon and the sun as well. And it's like, whoa, what are you saying here, Joseph? Well, I don't know if Joseph fully understood where those dreams were going to take him, but it was a dream that was in his heart. Well, you can imagine what was happening with that dream after being completely rejected by his brothers. Some of you know what rejection feels like. Some of you know it very well. We have a way of sometimes picking on the little guy too, don't we? I mean, when I was a kid, I've told you this story before, but you know, I used to pick on my little brother. I only had one little brother to pick on, so he got it all. And you know, he's 3 years younger than me, and so you know, me and my friends are out there. There's a puddle of water beside our house, and it looks really chocolatey, you know, kind of like chocolate milk. And we're saying, Gemma, that's chocolate milk. You know, you should drink that. And he's, no. No, it really is. You got to drink it, you know. And so he goes down and he actually takes a sip of that chocolate milk and it's like, and we're going, you know, laugh. Well, you know, we can be brutal as individuals. And some of us have really been brutalized by people. I mean, I can't imagine what it would have been like for Joseph. It says, the scripture says, you know, we delivered him up to the Ishmaelites in spite of his pleadings. This kid is pleading, no. 17 years old. Don't do this. This morning I was reminded of the fact that our families are sometimes the place of the greatest hurt in our lives. Jacqueline, why don't you come on up? Jacqueline was sharing this morning, and this wasn't planned, but Jacqueline was sharing this morning about why it was difficult for her to trust God because her own earthly family... Well, you can tell us, okay?
Okay. Well, my mom and dad sent me to a foster home when I was 8 years old. A friend of ours convinced them that I should go because I was strong-willed. But my other sister was going as well because she used to steal cars and, you know, got in trouble a lot. And they didn't want me to turn out like her, so I was sent along with her.
Wow. So that ended up having an impact on your lifelong, what kind of impact?
Well, the impact to me was I was beaten a lot when I was there. Quite frankly, I only remember one spanking, but I was beaten with a coffee cord. And I only know that because my sister was there, and she told me, and she finally threatened them that if they didn't stop beating me, that she was going to hurt them. But I only know that, I only remember once, and when that, the one time I remember is that I made a vow that nobody would ever hurt me like this again. So how it impacted me was I didn't feel worthy. When God would bring me a blessing, I would reject it. Mm. I was self-sabotage all the time. And I never married because of that, because I didn't want to get hurt. I didn't want a husband to reject me. So it's impacted me immensely. But God is so faithful. So I've been on a quest for like a year and of self-deliverance, and I asked God to show me what spirits were coming against me, and he showed me five. So every morning and every night I would cast that spirit out. Spirit of rejection was the strongest. And then following that, I asked God to show me more. He showed me 30 spirits that kept attacking me. Spirit of intimidation, spirit of isolation, you know, etc. But then I said, God, show me the opposite too, so I can put in what I'm missing. So the next 60 days, every morning I would get up and I would cast out those spirits and I would put in the good ones. And I did it at night too. So for 90 days I experienced this. And then I was still having some, I couldn't figure it out. There was just something missing. So I went to counseling. And
last week at the council session, my counselor is a Christian, and I just got inside of me that I didn't trust God. I couldn't totally trust him because my father did this to me, so how could I trust the God, you know? And I just started healing that, and that within that hour, literally, it started healing. And then yesterday, I was at home alone, and I have a menorah, and I light it now and then. But yesterday, I lit my menorah, and I was just praising God. And then all of a sudden, I just got within me, like, just ask God for freedom. And so I said, God, I want freedom. For 15, 20 minutes, I just kept saying that over and over again. And then I started saying, I have freedom. Mm. And then I went, freedom. And I was just, it was broken off. That hole that's been in my heart to trust God is healed and whole.
Wow. Thanks, Jacqueline. Isn't that powerful? If you take out your notes, we come to the very first statement. Point number one is this, that the most basic issue in our relationship with God is the issue of trust. Most basic issue. It always is going to come back to trust. Joseph certainly had to deal with that. He had to deal with, you know, I feel like I've got these dreams and there's something that's going to happen with my life, but now here I am in prison, I'm in Egypt, and my life is not going at all the way I had anticipated, and it's miserable. And he had to still come to the place of trust and confidence. All of what we've been reading up till now in the scripture has dealt with trust. Abraham, it's all about trust. I mean, this incredible trial that he goes through of having to, you know, being called upon by God to sacrifice his own son. The Hebrews, book of Hebrews tells us that he trusted God, that God would even bring his son Isaac back to life. If it was all about his confidence. Trust is an interesting thing because it's easily affected. It's easily impacted by experiences that we have. And in fact, I was talking with someone this morning about the fact that many times, you know, kids who grow up in the church and they hear about, you know, that God is good and that God is righteous and that God is the healer and that God is the victor, and they hear these stories and then things happen in their lives where they don't see that. They don't see that reality. In fact, many times they see the opposite. They see a person where we've prayed for them and then that person actually succumbs to the disease. Or they see some of the brokenness in the families around them. Or they see the imperfections of the church and of their faith. And so that trust begins to crumble. And trust is always going to be attacked. But it's the most central aspect of our faith always begins with trust. We put our faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, and we will be saved. And it's out of trust that restoration can take place. I just want to read a passage to you from Isaiah 61. Jesus quoted it at the very beginning of his earthly ministry. He said, "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." That's what Jackie's talking about. Jacqueline is talking about. That's what God was doing. He's announcing the year of his favor. Hey, you can trust. And that's what Joseph had to go through. It's the classic story of learning to trust in the midst of circumstances that don't look trustworthy. And I imagine that here on this day, many of us are saying, I want to trust God, but my circumstances just don't appear trustworthy. Part of the reason for us to come together Sunday after Sunday and praise and worship God together and sit under the ministry of His Word is that we get reminded, you know what, even when you don't see the answer, He's still got it. He's still bigger than you are. And He's still got a plan for your life. And in fact, the words of the sermon title, God intended it for good. You intended it for evil. You brothers, you intended it for evil. God had a plan all the way through. He intended it for good. That's an affirmation of trust. Sometimes, though, out of our lack of trust, we fall into the quagmire of self-pity. That's point two. Our lack of trust will lead us into the quagmire of self-pity. It's really interesting. One of the things that happened in the story, in the Joseph story, is that the brothers had gone down. Joseph now, in the meantime, his dreams have been fulfilled, and he has become the governor of all of Egypt. And he's in control of the whole deal. And there's a famine in the land, and so the brothers come down from Canaan into Egypt in order to get food for the family. Since Joseph is the governor of the whole land, he meets them. They don't recognize him. He's speaking Egyptian, and he looks, I mean, this years have gone by. He's looking very different. They don't recognize him at all. So he treats them very harshly. But he has a plan in mind. One of the things that he wants is he wants to see his younger brother from Rachel, Benjamin. He wants to see Benjamin. Benjamin hasn't been sent. Why? Well, because now he's the favorite son. And Jacob wants to hold on to him. And so he doesn't send Benjamin down. The other 10 brothers go down. And so Joseph is trying. He's trying to reconnect with his brother Benjamin. So he comes up with this plan to treat the brothers harshly and send them on their way and say, look, I'm going to keep one of you captive. He's going to have to stay here in prison. You're not going to get him back until you come back with your younger brother. And so... Now the 9 brothers return home, and Jacob is like crestfallen, you know, to see what's going on. So they come back, and they're emptying their sacks. And as they were emptying their sacks, there is, in each man's sack was his pouch of silver. And when they and their father saw the money pouches, they were frightened. And their father Jacob said to them, you have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and now you want to take Benjamin? Everything is against me. Because the brothers have told him that they're supposed to bring Benjamin back. Then Reuben said to his father, you may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring them back to you. Entrust him to my care, and I will bring him back. But Jacob said, my son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead, and he's the only one who's left. If harm comes to him on the journey you are taking, you'll bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow. Jacob is an interesting guy because he's seen God work in some really amazing ways. He's built altars to the Lord, commemorating God's presence. And he's seen God rescue him from his kind of really abusive father-in-law, Laban, and then his brother Esau that he was estranged from. And he's seen God put all these things together, but he's still... He hasn't learned trust. And so there's self-pity that is going on in his life. And so what we see here, and this is from R.T. Kendall, a British pastor, really powerful pastor, and he wrote a book called God Meant It for Good. And so he observes in this passage that, number one, self-pity is always going to blame others. Self-pity blames others. So, you deprived me of my children. He's blaming the brothers for what happened. Actually, he's somewhat at fault himself. He's the one who favored Joseph. He's the one who gave Joseph the coat of many colors, which was a sign of special blessing. In some ways, he set Joseph up for the mistake. But he's blaming, you know, you have deprived me of my children. So self-pity blames others. Secondly, self-pity jumps to bad conclusions without evidence. Self-pity jumps to bad conclusions without evidence. He says, Joseph is no more and Simeon is no more and now you want to take Benjamin. It's like, wait a minute. Simeon is not no more. He's in prison. All you need to do is send Benjamin to go get him. Joseph is not no more. He doesn't know that, of course. But self-pity is always going to go down that, the negative pathway. You know people like that? We're kind of in that self-pity trip. They're always going down the negative pathway. Third thing is that self-pity wants sympathy. Everything is against me. Self-pity wants sympathy, demands sympathy. Fourthly, self-pity refuses to accept sound advice. Self-pity refuses to accept sound advice. So Reuben says to his father, you may put both of my sons to death if I don't bring them back and trust him to my care. And I will bring him back and trust him to my care. And he's like, no, no. So we become, when we're caught up in self-pity, which originates from a lack of trust, then we don't accept sound advice. We don't accept wise counsel. We just see it bleakly. Fifthly, self-pity is insensitive to others' feelings. Boy, that, you know, you've been around people who are really kind of on in that self-pity thing, and it's like they're just blind to the way their talk impacts other people, right? So in this case, Jacob is saying, his brother is dead and he is the only one left. Benjamin's the only one left. Who's he saying it to? His sons. I mean, think about the impact of that, you know. He's speaking to his own son saying, well, Benjamin's the only one left. Well, what are we, chopped liver? You know, I'm... And then sixthly, self-pity threatens others with guilt. You will bring my gray head down in sorrow to the grave. Self-pity, that's one of the most devastating things about people who don't trust God, is then they get really focused on themselves, become self-pitying in their situation, and they're laying guilt trips on others. It's all someone else's fault. Some of us really have to think about that. Some of us really have to take a look at ourselves and say, wait a minute, where are the elements of Jacob's life in me? To what extent am I a blamer? To what extent am I someone who wants to lay a guilt trip on others? Always making it someone else's fault and not my own. Well, there is an alternative to self-pity. And that is what Joseph demonstrates for us in such a powerful way. So trust, and Joseph demonstrates it, it opens us up to incredible freedom, the freedom of forgiveness. The fact is that we don't have to go down that pathway of self-pity. With God's help, we can forgive as we are forgiven. That's the marvelous thing that God opens for us. So in chapter 50, at the very end of the story, long long after Joseph's Jacob is dead, and kind of at the point where Jacob dies, and years have gone by, and they've been living in Egypt. And so when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph saying, "Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you're to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now, please forgive the sins of your servants of God your father." And when their message came to him, Joseph wept. Why do you think he wept? I mean, it was like, "Oh, guys, you know, I've forgiven you so long. You've been living here so long. I forgave that a long time ago, and you still don't recognize it?" So Joseph wept. And his brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. It's interesting that what appeared to be years of harmony, where the brothers were living with their families in Goshen, and Joseph is still in the king's palace and still governor of Egypt and still in this position of power, it seemed like everything was okay, and that whole time the brothers were still trembling. But Joseph had genuinely forgiven. So they could have been walking in freedom like Joseph was. The freedom of forgiveness is an amazing thing. Jacqueline, you didn't talk about, you know, the whole thing of, and I don't know where you're at in that, in terms of the forgiveness of your parents. You know, that's a very, very hard thing, isn't it? I mean, it's like, my goodness, I was 8 years old, and you thought it was wiser to get rid of me than to keep me? But God is working healing in your heart and life. And I believe he's walking you into the freedom of forgiveness. There are four proofs here that we see that Joseph has truly forgiven. Number one, forgiveness doesn't want the other person who offended us to be afraid. Forgiveness doesn't want the person who offended us to be afraid. Frankly, if someone really has been on your case and someone has really been mean to you, don't you want them to just tremble a little bit? I mean, isn't that the natural? Like, "Don't you know what you did to me? You should be ashamed. You should feel sorry." When we've truly forgiven, we don't want the other person to fear. We've released it. Secondly, forgiveness refuses to take advantage of any superior position we may be in. So Joseph says, "Hey, am I God? Am I God? No. I may be the governor of Egypt, but I'm not God. I'm not going to lord it over you." Sometimes we may try to force someone to respect us. That's like putting ourselves in the place of God. True forgiveness means that you don't want the other person to think there's something special about you. In marriage relationship, I think that's where it gets tested more often than not, right? I mean, how often do you have, if those of you who are married, Do you have the feeling in your heart, I'm the one who forgives 75% of the time? And she should recognize how often I'm the one doing the forgiving. And you know, and we get into that place. I mean, it comes down to really, really simple stuff. I mean, I remember taking a marriage counseling course in which, you know, this typical scenario of, you know, this counselor was thinking about, you know, this whole thing of how we measure stuff and how we measure how well we do. And so he thought, okay, I'm going to do an experiment with my wife. I know absolutely that I clean up the dishes about 75% of the time. So I'm going to ask her what she thinks. So he went to his wife and said, honey, you know, I'm just wanting to know what you think. You know, how often do I clean up the dishes? How often do you clean up the dishes? And he's a clinician and he knows facts and he's got it all down. And he says, she says, oh, I do it about 75% of the time. That, I mean, that's just so typical. But genuine forgiveness, it refuses to take advantage. It takes the humble route. Joseph says, hey, am I in the place of God? Thirdly, genuine forgiveness expresses confidence that even the bad thing that happened to us, God intended for good. Even the bad thing that happened to us, God intended for good. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. That's an incredible thing. Do we get to that place where we recognize that, look, there are weird and tough and bad things that are going to happen to us in our lives. Some that we cause and some that are caused by others and some simply by circumstances. And do we have the trust to put our confidence in God and say, wait a minute, God, even in spite of these negative things that were so hurtful and so harmful to my growth and even my sense of joy now, do I have confidence to recognize that you can work all things together for good to those who love you and are called according to your purpose? That's what trust is about. And fourthly, forgiveness keeps on forgiving. Forgiveness keeps on forgiving. So he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. How many of you have ever heard Corrie ten Boom speak? I remember one of the stories that Corrie ten Boom would always tell was the story of the, it's really a metaphor. It's an analogy about the back of the stitched cloth. How many know that story? You know, Corrie ten Boom was a person who experienced incredible kind of suffering because of the Nazi occupation of the Netherlands, and actually you know, watched her sister die in a concentration camp, and you know, this the bleakness of what she went through. But she would always tell the story whenever I heard her, and I only had a chance to hear her a couple of times, but both times she told the story, and I imagine she told it often. She would say, you know, in fact, the one time I heard her, she held it up, and she held up a stitchery, and it was the backside, and it had all the pieces of string and knots, and it looked like a mess, and it was the back of a stitched cloth. And she said, this, you know, this is the side that we see. This is the glimpse we get this side of eternity. And it doesn't look like much. Looks messed up. But then she turns it around and said, but this is what God's doing. This is the beautiful stitchery that he's the beautiful picture of our life that he's putting together. And trust accepts that reality that God is doing a good thing. Do you know what I just want to close with this. I just love this. Even when we don't trust, Jesus trusts for us. He's the one who trusted God to go even to the cross, even to death, even to lay his life down. And my trust is so limited, but Jesus trusts for me. And so this morning, the call is to trust. I'd like the worship team to come forward, and we're going to close out. But I want to ask once again, give the opportunity to respond. It may be that you're going through something in your life that you don't understand. There's struggle there. There's lack of, the pieces of your life fitting together in the way that you would anticipate that they should. And it feels to you like you look at your life and it looks like the back of a stitch cloth. And you're not sure that, that you really do trust God. You might be like Jacqueline, where you've worked at it, and it's like, man, there's still this something missing, and I want to trust him. And so I would say, as we're singing today this song, these are this front of the sanctuary. We call it an altar because an altar is a place where there's a meeting with God. And so it can become just a concrete place of just coming forward and kneeling and saying, Lord, I need you to meet me at this point of where I'm having a difficulty trusting you. And just because you come forward doesn't mean you're, admitting to some big sin. It's just saying, I want to grow in my trust. And I want to really believe, God, that others may have meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, and that he's going to work all things together to those who love him and who are called according to his purpose. And so, why don't you stand? We'll sing this song. Oh God, how I need you. And I invite you to come, and in coming forward, it's just a symbolic way of saying, Lord, I need you.